the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest today is Dr. Wade Fow, and his subject, Why the 4% Rule Could Fail. You know, today's topic is probably one of the most important shows of the year on planning for retirement, and that includes our guest, Dr. Wade Fow, who will share extensive studies done on how to invest during retirement in order to avoid going broke. And Jim, you are going to further elaborate on these studies and share your 35 years of experience in retirement planning. What has worked? What are the major impediments to success? The reason we want to highlight today's show is that 10,000 boomers head into retirement every single day, and that's a trend that's going to remain in place over the next decade. And there are several converging trends that will affect them in retirement, many of which they are unaware. So let's begin our discussion with some of the standard rules and traditions regarding retirement investing. And Jim, how these rules no longer apply. They don't work.
Well, one of the things I'm going to be discussing with my guest today, Dr. Wade Fow, is the 4% rule, which is widely used in the planning industry. And for our listeners, the 4% rule, we've talked about this in the program, it came into play in 1994 in an article in the Journal of Financial Planning. It was theorized by a financial planner in California by the name of William Bengen. And what he was looking at was, what was a safe withdrawal rate, or a rate in which you could draw down your assets throughout your retirement years without going broke? Now, you got to remember, at the time he wrote this article, it was in 1994, interest rates were in the high single digits. In fact, the interest rates at that time were at 7%. And so people were using 7% withdrawal rates, thinking that the 7% rate of interest would last for their entire retirement. Well, think, if you were taking out 7% in 1994, what happened to you a decade later in 2004 when Greenspan brought interest rates down to 1%, or 2014 when interest rates are below 2%. So it was assumed to be a safe withdrawal rate. Now, what Bengen recognized was the 7% fixed rate of return used in retirement calculations masked the risk of financial market volatility. And what he discovered was a concept called sequence risk, which means the average return over a 30-year period might be high. Anytime you talk to somebody about the long rate returns in the stock market, they cite the 10% figure. But if negative returns occur early on when a person retires, the individual would be drawing down assets too rapidly in the early years of retirement, which would threaten the lifetime income, leading to a reduced lifestyle, or worse, going broke at your demise. And so he recognized, yeah, over long periods of time, the stock market may return 10%. We'll get into ways you could avoid this fallacy. But at that time, John, interest rates were at 7%, and thank goodness he came out with the 4% rule, and it began being applied, because 7% interest rates went away by the end of the decade, and we've never been back there ever since.
Yeah, if you look at this, you need to understand that Bengen looked at rates at a period when they were at about 7%, and he came up with a rule of 4%. Now, Dr. Wade Fow and others are now questioning that rule, given today's investment environment of, ta-da-da, 0% interest rates, and what's going on with global quantitative easing. So let's assume that Bengen's rule isn't working in that category. What is a safe rule or percentage if you don't want to get into trouble, Jim?
You know, the studies done by Fow and a lot of his peer group have shown, given today's low interest rates and higher stock market valuations, John, the safe withdrawal rate is dropped in half, from 4% to 2%. So the withdrawal rate, that's one that will work. Anything above that, retirees are taking major risks to their finances and their lifestyle. And Fow has shown that the 4% rule has a very low chance of success over an extended period of retirement.
And yet, you know, this is repeated as if it were somehow absolute orthodox truth to which you had adhere, because industry adheres to this rule. It's still used. It functions as an algorithm in RoboPlans and financial planning software. But your firm's come up with an alternative to that rule that has proven to be more successful. And that's what I want to get into right here. But perhaps before we do that, let's sum up the dynamics that we have nullified a standard rule of withdrawal rates of 4% and why that doesn't work anymore.
When you take a look at it, and a lot of our listeners are going to be able to relate to this, but the world has changed greatly since 1994, and even more so since the year 2000. But John, there are three main factors today that have come into play that question the relevance of the conclusion of the 4% rule. Number one, longevity. According to the Society of Actuaries, these are guys that work for insurance companies and figure out statistically the average lifespan of an individual, there is a 31% probability that a couple, age 65, one would live to see their 95th birthday. There's also a 50% chance of at least one person would live to see their 90th birthday. So number one, longevity. So people are living longer, and that means you're going to have to draw down on your assets over a longer period of time. We used to talk about 10-year retirement periods, then it went to 20. Now we're talking about 30-year periods of retirement. So imagine that your assets have to carry you over a 30-year period. The second one, which becomes obvious, we're looking at the lowest interest rates in 5,000 years of recorded human history. When the 4% rule came out, the interest rates were at 7%. And today, I want to give you an illustration of this. By the year 2000, interest rates had fallen from 7% down to 5%. So if you were retired and let's say you wanted $3,000 a month income, or roughly $36,000 a year to live on off your portfolio, you could have gone into a 2-year treasury note and it would have only taken $540,000 to produce that $36,000 a year. Fast forward to today in 2015 on this Friday, where the 2-year note is at 0.7%, it takes $5,142,000 invested in 2-year treasury notes to produce the same income that $540,000 would have produced in the year 2000. So you can see the dramatic change. And the third reason is the stock market valuations. If you look at the Shiller long-term average PE ratio, it's above historical averages. The higher the PE ratio, the lower the returns over a period of time. So, John, we're really in uncharted territory today. So the old rules or withdrawal rates don't work in this environment. And the risk is if you are drawing down your assets at a 4% rate, you run the risk of going broke or dramatically lowering your lifestyle if you plan to use those in terms of your withdrawal rate when you begin your retirement.
I know that you've discussed in past interviews with Wade Fow about the 4% rule no longer being valid. Now, what about the other rules which are used today? I mean, the percentage of fixed income based on age, so say age 60, should be 60% fixed income. The older you get, the more fixed income you should have. Extensive studies have been done that showed what the outcomes of these were.
Yeah, I mean, the conventional wisdom, besides the 4% rule, one of the other conventional wisdoms used in financial planning today is the age and bond ratio. In other words, asset allocation mix, thinking as a time horizon in retirement, shortens, and the buffer value of assets holding their period shortens. So the capacity for financial risk increases. So the theory has been the older you get, your equity exposure should decline accordingly. So let's say at age 60, you should have 60% in bonds. At age 70, 70% in bonds. And at age 80, 80% in bonds. Theoretically, if you live to 90, only 90% in bonds. However, given the reality of today's longevity pattern, the reverse holds true. Because of a longer time spent in retirement, you need to generate growth that is going to be necessary to maintain inflation-adjusted withdrawals if you want to maintain your lifestyle. If you start your retirement with, let's say, a high percentage in fixed income and increase that percentage each year as you age, then you're going to end up either having to reduce your lifestyle as you age or depend on your kids to support you, or even worse, end up broke. And we're going to get into some real life stories here that will demonstrate that. And this is one of the surprising things. We'll get into some of the outcomes, because Dr. Pfau and some of his peers just recently published a major study where they looked at the 4% rule. They took a look at the age bond ratio rule and a number of different permutations of fixed income stock allocations in terms of their probability of success. And what they found out is going to totally shock you if you're listening to this program, because it's going to turn upside down the conventional wisdom that has been used in the financial planning and the financial industry for the last three decades.
You know, when you realize that those are rather dramatic outcomes, and they may actually be uncomfortable when you think about it, but the other problem is they may be a reality and you have to deal with it.
Well, let me give you two case studies that are going to illustrate. I had a client of ours who had an aging mother. She was age 85, or she turned 85 this year. She was living in a house and she refused to sell the house and downsize. She liked the neighborhood. That was where the family grew up. That was where her husband and her lived through most of their marriage. So they built substantial assets in the value of the home. It went up in the last decade with the real estate market. At one time, at the peak, the value of the home got to be $1 million, which is substantial, especially for somebody living in Arizona. $1 million home is a substantial piece of property. Today, the value of that home is probably $700,000 and less. There was about a $200,000 mortgage on it. She was diagnosed a couple of years ago with the beginning signs of dementia. The problem was, earlier this year, she had a severe stroke. As a result of the stroke, she fell, hit her head on the kitchen tile, damaged the frontal lobes of her brain, setting into sequence Alzheimer's. Today, she's living in assisted care living, which is costing close to $6,000 a month. Plus, the house hasn't sold, so they've gone through the cash. They're liquidating her bond fund portfolio, and they're going to have to do that until the house was sold in order to aid my client and one other member of the family are paying a portion of her monthly living expenses, because she just had a new bill. It's called assisted living, and it costs $6,000 a month. There were no inflationary assets in the portfolio other than the house, which eventually, you know, peaked at $1 million in the last decade, and today is probably worth $700,000 or less because there's a lot of repair work that has to be done. The house is almost 40 years old. And so most of the assets outside the house were invested in CDs and a bond fund. We also have another case of an individual that is in a assisted living facility here in California, which is over $6,000 a month. And that individual is down to their last $150,000 in their portfolio. So outside Social Security income and this $150,000, basically in 2 years, this individual is going broke. I mean, basically, it's not really good to think of it in this way, but he has deteriorating health at this point, severe heart disease. But if he does live beyond that 2-year period when all of his funds run out, they're going to have to take a look at Medicaid as a means of taking care of him, but he won't be able to stay in that facility that is running over $6,000 a year. So here's two examples, John, where no planning was done to think about those expenses that all retirees run into in the latter part of their life.
As the baby boomers are retiring more and more, I'm sure we're going to hear more and more of these kinds of stories in the future. And a greater than 70% of retirees don't have a plan. Many are like your client's mother, who had no inflation hedge in the portfolio. So their later years, where medical issues rise up, could actually bankrupt an individual or their kids, or remove whatever is left of the estate. So, and you're not going to be able to count on government to pick up the tab, because I don't know if you've noticed it lately or not, Jim, but even the Republicans are starting to sound more like Democrats when it comes to Social Security. And it's obvious that everybody knows we're headed into a problem area there as well. So this may not be very stable in the future.
You know, the problem is, and this is something that isn't accounted for in a lot of these plans, if you think of a person that retires today, their expenses kind of look like a sandwich or an Oreo cookie. The first one-third phase of their retirement, expenses tend to be higher. When you retire, you now have free time to take the trips that you never could before. So, you know, you can afford to take 2 or 3 weeks and go to Europe or go to Asia or someplace else or go on an extended cruise. Then the second third of your retirement years, you tend to pull back. You don't travel as much. You're older. You know, the jet lag, the time differentials are much harder on you health-wise. Maybe you're starting to run into some health issues. And then finally, the last third of your retirement years are when, you know, you start running into the medical issues, as we just discussed with my client's mother having a stroke and now having to go into an assisted living facility. So the issues that we just mentioned, higher medical expenses, you know, the average couple, and we've talked about this on the program, depending on whose study you're reading, an average couple age 65 can plan on spending between $230,000 and $250,000 of out-of-pocket expenses on medical care. Now, Obamacare is going to make this worse. We covered this on last week's Lifetime Income, but because of Obamacare, Medicare needs to increase their revenues by 25%. Now, there's a problem with Medicare and Social Security. Social Security has a hold harmless clause, which says that every year, when you get your Social Security COLA adjustments and you get your Medicare adjustments, your overall net between your increase in your Medicare cost and your increase in your Social Security benefits, they cannot be negative, meaning that as a result of increases in your Medicare premiums, the result is you end up with less benefits from your Social Security. The Medicare premium increases outweigh what you're getting in, let's say, Social Security benefits, and you get less. So what happened is anybody that signs up for Medicare at age 65 and does not take Social Security because they're working or they're going to extend their Social Security, you are going to see a 52% increase in your Medicare premiums beginning January 1st. So here's another example of how Obamacare is impacting not only insurance, where a lot of people aren't able to keep their doctors, their premiums are going up at high single digits, contrary to what we were told, but here how it's affecting Medicare. They need to increase Medicare taxes or revenues by 25%. So the result is Obamacare is increasing the cost of medical coverage, and that means they're either going to have to increase taxes, increase the premium payments, in this case 52% for those that are not on Social Security but are on Medicare, and it may come that a couple retired today, John, they better plan for it if they want to avoid the two case studies we just talked about where my client's mother had a stroke and is now in an assisted care facility, and the other gentleman who is down to his last $150,000 and he's spending over $6,000 a month in a facility. So he's got about 2 years left before he runs broke. And so these are the kind of stories, John, you're going to hear more and more as a result of Obamacare and also as a result of the more boomers retiring and investing in the wrong type of assets.
All right, let's swing back to today's guest, Wade Fow, who has done recent studies on retirement income withdrawal rates. What does work in today's low interest rate environment where life extensions keep increasing with advances in medical care and nutrition?
Well, you know, it's interesting because Fow and his colleagues just published a major study looking at the 4% rule, the bond age allocation, the set and forget it allocation based on age, asset allocation formulas, whether it's 4%, 5%, asset liability matching, and the largest sustainable withdrawal rates from a portfolio. They tested just about every single approach you could think of regarding asset allocation approaches, and then ran Monte Carlo simulations testing for failure rates. And what they wanted to achieve is a success rate of greater than 90%, meaning the probability of failure less than 10%. The reason they wanted that 90% success rate is they didn't want to run into unexpected contingencies, bear markets, expenses, etc., where you would end up outliving your assets or running down your assets. In the case of the two cases I just mentioned, where both individuals were in assisted care facilities, one gentleman going to go broke in 2 years, in the other case, unplanned for expenses with no inflationary increases, and now the children are funding part of the monthly expenses as a result of being put into a long-term care facility. So the result, John, is the opposite. Their studies found were the opposite of what the financial industry recommends and what retirees are actually doing today in the way they invest. And the results of their study consistently show support, and get ready for this, a rising equity glide path in portfolios, meaning as you age, the percentage of assets in stocks should increase, not decrease. According to the studies, your allocation at the day you retire should be double the allocation in stocks at the date of your death. And we're going to demonstrate and show why this is the case. John, this totally turns the financial planning industry upside down. In fact, at the conclusion of their study, the name of the study, by the way, is called Reducing Retirement Risk with a Rising Equity Glide Path. And the last page of their study was implications for financial planners in the financial planning industry is that you're doing the wrong thing with your clients. And so this was a rather dramatic outcome, and we'll be talking to Professor Wade Fowle coming up later on in today's program.
You have to realize this is the opposite of what is practiced today by the industry at large. They don't seem to have gotten the message. It's also opposite of the way that boomers have invested their portfolios since the financial crisis began, 2008, somewhere along there. So this turns the tables upside down on retirement planning. And as we said, the industry hasn't really caught on to this.
No, and what was surprising, what the FAO study found, the highest success rate they found was signified by the standalone result of, in other words, you should start your equity allocation a little bit lower at the beginning of your retirement years. And I'm going to talk about our own solution that gets around that and shows a greater success rate. But they did a simulation starting your retirement with a 30% allocation to equities, rising to 80% by the end of retirement. That provided the highest chance of success in every simulation they did. More generally, any allocation that begins in, let's say, the 30 to 40% range in equities should finish in the 60 to 80% allocation by the time of your death. In other words, instead of decreasing as a percentage of your portfolio, as you age and the longer time you spend in retirement, your equity allocation should increase. And there are natural reasons for that, because every year your expenses are going to go up. And for retirees, the government now has a separate CPI. And like young people who have a higher inflation rate because of college cost, it's likewise with elderly Americans who are retired. They have a higher inflation rate, primarily due to the expense of medical. And this is something, John, like I said, this is surprising for the financial industry, because that's not the way financial plans are structured. And I've seen this with many of my own clients. You know, I've been in this industry doing retirement planning for 35 years, and my wealthiest clients are those that are heavily weighted towards equities. My least wealthiest clients are those that are in cash, bonds, and gold. And so I've experienced this in real time with my own experience going beyond three decades doing retirement planning.
You know, I know your firm takes a different approach to retirement planning than the industry at large. So explain how you differ and the reason for the difference in the approaches that you take.
Well, a number of reasons. I sort of discovered this the hard way in the 80s and the early part of the 90s, is we don't use the cookie cutter approach formulas or any percentage formula when we do a financial plan. And one of the things, and for those of you listening to this program, you should be familiar with this, because we emphasize this over and over. What we tend to do when we do a retirement plan is we isolate the budget into basic expenses, the bucket list expenses, and want list. So what we want to do is isolate, what does it really cost our client to live on a day-to-day basis in retirement. We're not talking about taking trips, buying new cars, new motorhomes. You know, what's the cost of just basic living expenses, health insurance premiums, food, insurance costs, housing costs? Then what we do, when we know what that number is, we target basic expenses with predictable sources of income streams, either through a company pension, a government pension, annuities, Social Security, or a laddered bond portfolio, because what we want to do is assure the client that their basic living needs are going to be met. Now, once we've met all those basic living expense needs, then the balance of the portfolio we put into blue chip dividend paying stocks, because they're going to raise those dividends over time and appreciate over time. And we're hitting a greater success ratio of over 90%, because it's a better approach rather than coming up with some magic formula rule like the 4%, 3%, or the age to bond ratio rule. It makes more sense because everybody's a little different. They live in different parts of the country. Their expenses are a little different. Their asset structure is different. They may have pensions. They may have better Social Security benefits, and they may have different asset sizes in terms of their portfolio. So that's why I just really think this cookie cutter approach to using formulas really doesn't work, because every individual is different.
Why is it you think that the industry doesn't recognize this change and doesn't apply new rules to a changing situation?
I think a number of reasons. Number one, I think there's misperceptions regarding risk when it comes to the stock market. For example, if I own a stock, I don't care, Exxon, Coca-Cola, Johnson & Johnson, if you go through a market correction, or if you go through a bear market where stocks fall 30, 40%, there's this perception if the stock market goes down, your income goes down. That is not true. If I own, 100 shares of Coca-Cola, and Coca-Cola's stock falls by 30%, which is what it did in the financial downturn between 2007 and 2009, my dividend did not change on Coca-Cola. If I owned 100 shares and Coca-Cola was paying $1 a share in 2007, I got $100 because I owned 100 shares. In 2008, I actually got more than $100 because Coca-Cola raised its dividend by 8%. In 2009, I got more than $108 because Coca-Cola raised its dividend another 8%. So when you use individual stocks, and this is why we use individual stocks and individual bonds, is I have greater certainty, greater predictability, and less chances for loss of income. In contrast, if I use a bond fund or a stock fund, and I'm using some magic formula like a 4% withdrawal rate, I'm drawing down my mutual funds, selling off my mutual funds or my ETFs in a period of declining stock prices, meaning that every month I have to sell more shares to get my income because the market's going down. So the industry is geared towards these pie chart and package products in the set and forget it mentality. I mean, think of the last 7 years or the last decade, what happened to interest rates. This is not the way, John, wealthy families maintain their lifestyle. Most individuals that I know that have portfolios, wealthy individuals that have portfolios at $10 million or more, if they're with a trust company or financial advisor, they're more likely to be using individual stocks and bonds because wealthy families want predictability and they want to remain wealthy. So you have individual stocks, they tend to have a higher percentage of portfolios because think of Warren Buffett. Why is he the second richest man in the world? Because he owns equities and he runs his insurance company investing in companies and equities. That's why he's become so wealthy. And that's what you see in wealthy families. I mean, we have a client that's over $50 million. There's not 1 cent of his portfolio that is in mutual funds or ETFs. He has individual bonds. He has individual stocks. And you see this with the wealthier families. When you see assets of $25, $50, or $300 million, you don't see these pie charts or mutual fund portfolios, because what they're looking for is predictability and a success rate. And you don't get that with some of these other programs.
Now, why do you believe this works versus what has been practiced and is still practiced by the industry at large?
I think, John, probably more than anything else is predictability. I know that if I put together a laddered bond portfolio, and let's say I get a bond paying 4%, matures in 10 years, I know for the next 10 years, my client's going to get 4% income. So if I put $100,000 in the bond, he's going to get $4,000 income every single year. It's not going to change no matter what Janet Yellen does or Ben Bernanke does. Secondly, if I put the client in individual stocks, yes, the stocks can go down like in the recent two-week correction that we got in the month of August, but the dividends did not change. If you own 100 shares of Coca-Cola, Exxon, Johnson & Johnson, whatever the blue chip stock is, your dividend did not change. So I know that if I own Coke, I know what my dividend income is going to be. I know if I have a laddered bond portfolio, I know exactly what my income is going to be from those bonds, and I know exactly what it's going to be when those bonds mature. So why do you think people like Buffett, for example, let's take Coca-Cola. Buffett bought Coca-Cola in 1988. He has held it ever since then. He's made, today, Buffett owns 400 million shares of Coca-Cola. He owns 9.2% of the company. His percentage of Coca-Cola has increased as a result of Coca-Cola buying back its stock. One of the requirements that Buffett likes to see in the companies that he invests in and owns long term. Since he bought that stock in 1988, we had a recession in 91. We had a Gulf War. We had another recession in 2000. We had the bursting of the tech bubble. We had the financial bubble. And Buffett today has got a profit in Coca-Cola that is worth anywhere from $6 to $8 billion by simply buying Coke and holding on and watching his dividends grow each year along with his ownership. And that's why this works. And that's why you see this. It's a very common trait that you see in wealthy families' portfolios. You're going to see them more towards individual bonds and individual stocks for the very reasons I just mentioned.
Okay, if we take what you've learned in 35 years doing retirement planning and what we've learned from studies such as those done by Wade Fowle and others to find out what actually works, what would you recommend to people who are looking at their retirement situation?
Well, first of all, if you haven't retired or getting close to retirement, I don't care if you're a millennial, you just got out of college, start putting together a plan. So if you are retired, put a plan in place and avoid what I call these cookie cutter approaches that take a percentage or some kind of formula. You know what? The thing that Wade Fowle has shown in these studies, they don't work. Because everybody's a little different, and we certainly live in different times to the three things I mentioned. People are living longer, we're looking at the lowest interest rates in 5,000 years, and the P/E ratio on stocks are much higher. And update your plan and stick to it and avoid what we've seen happen in the last couple of weeks, the emotional decisions to react to every headline crisis that we have every single year. I can't think of one year in my investment career that we've had crises from the 87 stock market crash, the Paris Accord that led to the downturn in the dollar, recessions, wars, banks going under, financial crisis. And don't make your investment decisions from the point of fear. If you are reacting emotionally out of fear, you are going to make unreasonable decisions that you'll later regret that will sabotage the financial well-being of your retirement. Instead, have a plan, make your decisions from reason and rational thought, and start looking at market corrections and use them to your advantage in much the same way that Warren Buffett does. Anytime he likes a company that he wants to accumulate, he waits for the opportunity. Either they miss their earnings, they have a bad product launch, and then he goes in and buys those shares and accumulates at a lower price. I mean, this never has made sense to me, but a couple of weeks ago, Coke was at $42 a share with a 3% dividend. Today, the price of Coca-Cola has fallen to a little over $38, and the dividend yield is at 3.5%. It really worries me, John. When I see what investors are doing today, in my 35-year career in the business, I have never seen such self-destructive behavior as what I see today, where individuals panic at every crisis, they go to cash, and forget about paying tax consequences that are much greater than the 10% correction in the market, or worse, they go out and buy gold. I mean, if you bought gold a couple of weeks ago in the crisis. I hope you sold it because it's down from that period of time. So at least from our perspective, looking at what we see on the macro basis, Greg Weldon talked about this on the weekend program and other technicians. You know, right now, gold is dead as an asset class with a rising dollar, and it's likely to remain that way for several more years. I mean, that's not to say you can trade it if you're an agile trader, but don't bank on it. And besides that, you're not going to live off gold if you're looking for income.
Right. So to sum it up, as always, we say here on the program, you should start with a plan. Look at what your projected needs are going to be in retirement, considering all the factors, and we've done other programs on that. Come up with a budget, design a portfolio which matches what you need to have happen personally in your circumstances, rather than a percentage formula or age formulas, or even worse, for formulas that are called pie chart or set and forget. Stick to your plan and use various corrections as needed according to what the market is doing in order to accumulate the income in your portfolio for retirement. Stick to a plan using market corrections to accumulate income-producing assets, which will produce income over time. And then, here's the big part, have the intestinal fortitude and the discipline to follow through with your plan. Well, as always here on Lifetime Income, we have a real-life case study generated from, you might have guessed it, real life, but we changed the names to protect the people who are involved. Nevertheless, these life studies are real.
This week's case is Mike and Deborah Schultz. This was a client that was referred to me by his father. His father attended one of my retirement seminars in the 80s. We did a financial plan. And as a result of that financial plan, we set his father and mother up with a plan. We updated, created a trust, estate plan. And in the process, he says, you know, I have a son who's a doctor who's been having some problems with some investment issues. So he referred me, his son, as a client. Now, one of the things that made Mike and gave him a success in life is his father had put aside a substantial amount of savings over the years to provide for his college education, because unlike many doctors, he got through medical school with no loans. And anybody going to medical school that's a doctor listening to this program, I don't need to tell you what you spent for your college education and medical school afterwards. So when Mike and Deborah came to me, we wanted a plan. A couple things that we wanted to set out. Like any couple starting out in life, he was fortunate enough, he had enough money for a down payment on a house, so they already had the house, so we didn't have to think about coming up with money for a house. That was already taking place with his income as a doctor because he didn't have any student debt. He qualified for a house. So what were important to Mike and Deborah at the time was providing for their children. They had three children. They had three bar mitzvahs they wanted to pay for. They had college education they wanted to pay for. And there were going to be two weddings that they were going to have to pay for. And then, of course, Mike and Deborah's own retirement. And we started that plan in the 80s. We start setting aside X percentage of his income would go into a retirement plan, because being a doctor, he was in a higher tax bracket. That was back in the days, John, when you used to get all kinds of deductions for sales tax and all kinds of deductions on your itemized tax return. So his main deductions for lowering his taxes was his mortgage expense, his property taxes, his contributions that he made to his synagogue. Those were his itemized deductions. Then he had exemptions for his kids. They didn't phase them out back then. And then on top of that was his pension plan. So we automatically started a savings program where money was going into his pension plan. And he started that early on in his career. And his goal back then, now remember, this is back in 1984 and 1985, when interest rates, I could get 14% on a Ginnie Mae. And his goal at retirement was to have $1 million, thinking of interest rates at that time were roughly 14%, which was roughly what he was making as a doctor back in 1984. So he wanted to have $1 million accumulated, and we showed, based on market long-term returns and what he was putting in his pension plan every year, he would have that at retirement. So the other priorities were to fund three bar mitzvahs, fund three college educations, and then fund for two weddings in addition to the retirement. To make a long story short, at age 65, he was able to retire with full Social Security benefits and not worry about losing part of his benefits. But at age 65, instead of having $1 million, we had closer to $2.5 million of assets that were accumulated. We got the kids through their bar mitzvahs. We got the kids through college and paid for two weddings. And at age 65, he had $2.5 million. But the problem was, at age 65, he said, "Jim, I don't feel like retiring." So he ended his work with the one practice he was affiliated with and went to another practice and worked part-time. And his goal was to leave his assets accumulate until he got to age 70, at which time he would have to take mandatory distributions from his retirement plan. And then at that time, he was going to quit work. And that's exactly what happened. So here we are. He's now age 72. He is actually taking money, drawing down from his retirement plan. Instead of $2.5 million, we have over $4 million in his retirement plan. And his goal, which we've also exceeded, is to leave $1 million to each one of his kids, because he wanted to do for his kids and his grandchildren the same thing his father had done in putting money aside to pay for his schooling and education, becoming a doctor, so leaving medical school with no debt. We are now working with two of his children with a financial plan. One is married to a petroleum engineer for one of the major oil companies and already has accumulated close to a seven-figure net worth with accumulated stock options and various benefits. So here's a three-generation plan, John, that began. But once again, the reason that we have $4 million in this portfolio is the portfolio was overweighted more towards equities versus fixed income because of his earnings ability, number one, during his working career being a doctor. And secondly, even when he semi-retired at age 65, he kept his assets in equities because he was making money part-time working in a practice. So here's a case, John, where we not only hit our goals, but I think the key to it is we had a plan. He started at an early age. He had the intestinal fortitude to stick to that plan. And I don't care if it was the recession, S&L crisis, the peso crisis, the Asia crisis, the Y2K crisis, the recession, the second Gulf War, financial crisis. We always had a plan. We adhered to that plan, and it produced the results we intended.
Coming up next, Wade Fow, why it is the 4% rule could actually fail. The climate has changed, and we need to examine exactly how as lifetime income continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, for years, the standard in financial planning in retirement was the 4% rule. You take out 4% of your principal, and theoretically, it would last you your entire lifetime in retirement. But today's low interest rates at zero, high P/E ratios for the stock market, that may no longer be true. Joining us on the program is Dr. Wade Fow. He's professor of retirement income at the American College. And professor, let's begin with the 4% rule, because for those of us in the financial planning industry, this was sort of a standard that was practiced. Individuals were told if they withdrew 4% of their principal, it would last them throughout their lifetime. And that basically came into being in the 90s with the Bengen article that was written for the Journal of Financial Planning back in 1994.
Yeah, Bengen was just thinking about if you had a 50-50 portfolio of stocks and bonds and didn't pay any sort of investment fees and were basically invested in these underlying indices rebalancing annually, that the worst case scenario in the U.S. historical record, which is a relatively short period of time, just looking at 30-year retirements, that's starting years now between 1926 and 1985, that a 4% initial spending rate was the worst case scenario in the U.S. historical record.
You know, a couple of things have happened that have changed that scenario, and I wonder if we can address these issues. Number one, with changes in medical technology, people are living longer. I can remember when Social Security was put into place, the average male was expected to live between ages 63, 65. Now men are living in their 80s, some in their 90s. So one, we've seen an increase in life expectancy, which means that you're going to spend more of your years in retirement, which means your assets have to last you longer. And the second aspect of this is the investment environment today. You know, where I'm looking at a Bloomberg screen, Professor, where I have 1-year treasury bills at a little over 0.3%, 2-year treasury bills are at less than 0.8%. So we have lower returns and longer life expectancy. Is that one of the reasons why, in your opinion, the 4% rule is no longer valid or working?
Right. Both of those issues are important. When Bengen did that research in the 1990s, he was just implicitly thinking of a 65-year-old couple and was thinking that 30 years is a relatively conservative life expectancy for the longest living person in the couple, which is going to be longer than the life expectancy for any given individual. But right, longevity continues to increase. The Society of Actuaries runs some of the key numbers that are used, and when they updated their analysis from the year 2000 to 2014, they were getting 2-year longer life expectancies beyond age 65 for males and for females. And that's just in that 14-year period. So 30 years may have been more conservative in the 1990s. It's not so conservative anymore. And that's the one issue. And the other issue, as you're pointing out, the 4% rule is supposed to be based on the worst case scenario in U.S. history. And so a lot of times people just think, well, the U.S. history has a lot of market volatility, that includes the Great Depression and so forth. But we really are in uncharted waters now in terms of interest rates being at such low levels. Really, the only other experience of that was in the early 1940s. And then at the same time, Robert Shiller's cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio, which has done a pretty good job about predicting sustainable spending in retirement, that is at nosebleed sections. It's at very high levels that really the only time in history in that period up till 1985 where we know final retirement outcomes. It was 1929, the year that the Great Depression began. That was the only other year we saw such high market valuations. And we've never seen both at the same time. So when you combine the increased longevity with this market environment that we really haven't experienced before, it's not to say that the 4% rule won't work for current retirees, but it certainly is riskier than people are led to believe when they just hear the idea that 4% is a safe withdrawal rate.
You know, one of the things that I've found, and I've been doing financial planning for more than 3 decades, is that the expenses of somebody that retires are kind of like a sandwich in the sense that a lot of expenses up front in the early years because you retire, you know, maybe you take up hobbies that you didn't have the time, you're doing more of your traveling while you're still healthy. And then midway through your retirement, you got the traveling out of your way. But then the last part of your retirement, that's when medical expenses really come into play. I was last weekend with a client whose mother had a stroke and is now in a long-term care facility, and that's now running $6,000 a month. So, you know, she's age 85, and that was an expense that the family wasn't planning on, but nonetheless, you know, $6,000 a month, that's $72,000 a year. That's a big expense.
Yeah, that's right. And to your first point, one of the arguments you can make, a saving grace, again, to help the 4% rule is the idea the 4% rule assumes you're going to increase your spending consistently throughout retirement. But in that first thing you mentioned, where people do naturally tend to spend more early in retirement and decrease their spending later on, well, if that's your spending pattern, you can spend more initially because you don't have to support as much spending later. But then as you're pointing out as well, there's that uncertainty about what kind of expenses are going to be associated with health care and long-term care when somebody gets into those higher ages. And in that regard, I think it still can be a good idea to plan for that inflation-adjusted spending, even if you don't end up doing that because you do stay in good health and do otherwise reduce your travel and so forth. That is an important uncertainty that if you're going to try to fund that through your own assets, you need contingency funds. You need to have an extra cushion of additional assets that are available and may otherwise go unused if you don't run into those types of problems.
You know, one of the things that I've also seen in studies in terms of retirement, Professor, is that a lot of financial planning software incorporates inflation rates like 2-3%, or you can put in a number. And what I've found in studies that I've read is that different age groups experience different levels of inflation. So, for example, a young millennial who is facing college expenses may face a higher inflation rate because of the cost of books, tuition, room and board may be more expensive. Likewise, an older individual in retirement, especially when you get into your 70s, or in the case of the client whose mother is now in a retirement facility at almost $6,000 a month, those inflation numbers are much different. So it seems like a lot of the parameters and assumptions that are made in long-term retirement plans are no longer holding true, which is another reason I think that you have to have a more dynamic planning process, because look at the changes that are coming about with Obamacare. Look at the changes that came about with the Fed's zero interest rate policy. These were things that, you know, if you and I were talking about retirement planning back in 2000, we wouldn't have ever thought of something like this.
Yeah, you make a lot of good points. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics has confirmed with, they have an experimental consumer price index for the elderly. And it's really, with healthcare rising faster than general inflation, the elderly do tend to experience a higher inflation rate than the general public. And that's certainly a limitation. And right, with all these uncertainties, it is important to maintain flexibility. The 4% rule sometimes gets cast as a set it and forget it type of rule, that right at your initial retirement date, you can determine how much you're going to be able to spend every year forever. But in reality, no one's going to follow that so precisely. And to the extent that people are flexible and do have the capacity to reduce spending if necessary, and then the potential to increase spending as well if the markets are doing well in retirement, then having that capacity to adjust spending really can be beneficial and can also allow someone to spend a little bit more initially because they have the capacity to reduce spending later if necessary.
You know, something also that I think that is not planned for, the studies that I've read that a couple today retiring could probably spend anywhere from $230,000 to $260,000 out-of-pocket expenses for medical. And that's just something that most people don't put in their retirement budget. They might put travel, they might put, you know, their cost of housing and food and various sundries of the cost of living, but they may not be thinking about, oh, I'm going to spend $250,000. I'm sure, Professor, you've seen some of these numbers, but, you know, when you're talking about a couple $100,000 for out-of-pocket medical expenses, let's just take a 25-year retirement and $250,000. That's an extra $10,000 a year in the budget that should be planned for.
And the difficulty there as well is that that's the average. And so some people will be spending less than that, but others will be spending much more than that. It speaks to some issues around having some sort of plan for long-term care needs that goes beyond just trying to self-finance that. Although certainly those who do have that additional cushion of assets can go the route of self-financing. But you're right, definitely people do need to be thinking about the fact that their medical and long-term care expenses in retirement are going to be potentially higher than pre-retirement.
Professor, let's talk about what is typically done in retirement. So let's take an individual 65. A lot of the financial planning software today puts together these pie charts, and you have this allocation model. You're going to have so much in large cap stocks. You're going to have so much in bonds or bond funds. And the other thing that is uncertain today, and I know you've done studies on this using annuities, or we prefer laddered bond portfolios, because you don't have any certainty with the bond fund. But let's talk about the static approach to retirement. Oh, you're age 65. This is your pie chart. This is the percentage or allocation of your portfolio. And a lot of that just doesn't apply today, whether you're looking at the low investment returns on investments, the valuations of stocks, the fact that you're living longer, the fact that medical or inflation expenses are much different. Let's talk about that, because I think the industry needs to adapt and be more flexible given the environment today that takes into account this uncharted territory that we seem to find ourselves in.
Yeah, a lot of software does sort of base its analysis on historical averages for stock returns and bond returns. And especially with the bond returns, it's just mathematically impossible at this point to get the historical average bond return when you start from such low initial yield levels. Because, you know, when interest rates go up, bond funds are going to have capital losses. It's a tough environment. There's a lot of different ways to look at asset allocation in the retirement. I think you might be kind of pointing at that conventional wisdom is more to continue to decrease your stock allocation throughout your retirement and whether that's appropriate in this type of environment.
You recently did a study where the conclusion was the 4% rule is significantly more risky for today's retirees who face fees, low bond yields, high stock market valuations, and increasing longevity. Now, you also did another study called Reducing Retirement Risk with a Rising Equity Glide Path. And I'm sure for many of our listeners right now, Professor, this is not going to make sense intuitively, because you think when you retire, you're looking for safety. As you get older, you're even more concerned about safety. But according to the studies that you've done, actually, you may be better off starting out with a lower equity allocation to your portfolio in the early years, let's say anywhere from 30 to 40%, and then increase that equity allocation as you get older. I can tell you right now, that's the opposite of what is being done in the industry.
Yeah, part of the issue there is the 4% rule type of analysis recommends that retirees hold a pretty aggressive stock allocation in retirement. Bengen, in his initial article, said retirees should have 50 to 75% stocks, but as close to 75% stocks as possible. And that really hasn't ever been overturned. That kind of shows up consistently. However you're doing the simulations or looking at the problem, more aggressive stock allocations tend to result in lower probabilities of running out of money. And so that's really the starting point that we were responding to the extent that people are not comfortable with that. And also, I think outside of that financial planning research area about sustainable spending in retirement, people are not using such aggressive stock allocations in their retirements. And so our starting point was more a matter of, well, instead of having to hold 50 to 75% stocks throughout your retirement, you should have a potentially a lower stock allocation at retirement, but then you could gradually work your way back up towards that level. With the basic idea being that you want to have the lowest stock allocation in your lifetime when you're the most vulnerable to wealth losses. And you're the most vulnerable to losing wealth when your portfolio is the biggest, which in a traditional kind of model about somebody going through life, their portfolio will generally be the biggest around retirement. And so that's prior to retirement, I agree with the idea you decrease your stock allocation with age, like target date funds do. But post-retirement, I don't think it's necessarily a good idea to continue to decrease your stock allocation with age. The research has pretty consistently shown that, at the very least, having a fixed stock allocation throughout retirement is superior to continuing to decrease the stock allocation. And then in this work I did with Michael Kitsis, we took it even farther and said, well, what if you actually increase the stock allocation? And you can think about that in different ways as well. It could just be you actually increase the stock allocation in your financial portfolio. But we originally stumbled upon this more thinking about the entire household balance sheet, where if someone buys an income annuity at retirement, thinking about the present value of all their future annuity payments as well as part of their household assets. And then if somebody ages, the annuity allocation on their household balance sheet is going to decrease. And as long as the stock market is not doing terrible throughout retirement, it probably means that on this household basis, the stock allocation as a percentage of their overall household assets is going to increase naturally. And so even though somebody may not think in terms of increasing their stock allocation in their financial portfolio by itself, it may be a natural outcome for a lot of retirees that their stock allocation as a portion of all their entire household assets will naturally increase throughout retirement, and they might not even think about it or realize it.
You know, one of the things that you hear periodically is somebody passes away, and you read about these stories in the Wall Street Journal. There was a couple months ago, a 90-year-old gentleman who started out as a gas station attendant in his brother's gas station, ended up becoming a janitor at JCPenney's, but he fell in love with the stock market. He bought a lot of blue chip stocks, never sold them, used his dividends to reinvest during market downturns. And when he passed away at age 90, he had over $9 million. And this sort of goes with this concept that we're talking about, an increasing equity glide path, because if you buy these blue chip stocks, and you've done a number of studies in this area, but you know, you buy a company like Coca-Cola that's increased its dividend averaging 8 to 9% a year. Imagine a company like that, or what we call dividend aristocrats, over 20, 25 years of increasing dividends, well, for the average retiree, that means that every single year they're getting a pay increase. And that's really, I think, the key in why so many of these studies show that a larger equity allocation results in greater success of living off those assets, because your income is increasing. And we know that when you increase dividends over a long period of time, the asset itself, usually the stock, goes up.
Yeah. Historically, of course, stock outperformed bonds, and that's a driving factor there. Of course, there's the downside risk associated with stocks, but certainly in these cases, like that gentleman you mentioned, we've had a very good stock market performance in the United States. Even with the occasional dips, the market usually recovers fairly quickly. And so in that kind of situation, somebody who has a fairly frugal lifestyle and who consistently is saving and buying into the stock market, those kinds of scenarios could happen with those past returns that we've experienced, having that $9 million remaining at the end.
You know, Professor, I have found, at least in our own work and planning, that we've gotten greater consistency and greater success. Like, for example, in the fixed income realm, we use individual bonds because I know the maturity date. I know exactly what the income's going to be versus, let's say, individuals that went into bond funds in the last decade saw their income or dividends decrease as interest rates were brought down. And likewise, we have found the same success using individual stocks, because if I know if I own a Coca-Cola in a portfolio, the stock could go down in a market downturn, which exactly happened to Coca-Cola in 2008 and 2009. But in 2008, Coca-Cola increased its dividend 8%. In 2009, they increased it another 8%. So the income to the individual did not drop, or there were no losses in income, even though the value of the portfolio might have dipped. Have you found similar results in studies that you have done that, for example, an individual stock or an individual bond gives you greater predictability than, let's say, using a fund where you don't know what's going to happen with withdrawals and downturns or changes in the portfolio given what the investment manager is doing?
Yeah, definitely on the side of bonds, my research has indicated that, especially for retirees, holding those individual bonds to maturity, giving the ability to essentially ignore the interest rate risk, is more effective than holding on to bond funds that experience market volatility and therefore continue to expose the retiree to sequence risk, which just is having to sell at a loss. So that definitely, yeah, that holds up on the bond side. On the stock side, I've not done much research myself about individual stocks and dividend paying stocks as a particular strategy relative to just holding a stock index fund or mutual fund. But certainly the potential is there. It's just not something I've looked at in great detail.
Yeah, it's something that we're doing a study on right now where we're taking the dividend aristocrats of companies that have increased their dividends 25 years in a row and taking a basket full of those stocks and back testing how the income would have held up during periods of stress, because certainly we've seen a lot of those. You know, we had a recession in 91, we had a crash in 87, we had the Gulf War, we had the Asian crisis, we had the default on Russian debt, we had the bursting of the tech bubble, we've had the financial crisis in the last decade. So certainly we've had, over the last two or three decades, we've had a lot of periods of volatility and downdrafts in the market. So we're back testing that. Professor, let's talk about annuities, because you've done some studies with annuities and you have found the predictability in their use in providing secure income. Talk about the results that you have found of annuities in place of bonds.
Yeah, I like to think of, in this case, particularly income annuities, which the single premium providing an income for life, they're the relatively straightforward and uncomplicated versions of annuities. And they basically behave, I call them actuarial bonds, because the underlying assets are invested in a fixed income or bond portfolio. But the benefit of them is that they provide income to the individual for precisely the amount of time that individual needs income. It's linked to their lifetime. If the lifetime is short, unfortunately, well, then that person didn't need as much income. But if that person lives a long time, the income annuity continues to pay, and they provide the additional benefit. They can provide payments based on somebody building a ladder of bonds out to about their life expectancy, whereas somebody who's trying to self-manage the risk of outliving their life expectancy would want to build a bond ladder that would be much longer. And the longer that ladder, the less you're able to spend each year. So that income annuities allow you to spend more than you could potentially be able to spend on your own if you try to manage that risk on your own. And that's really where I see the benefit of income annuities as an alternative to having bond funds in a retirement income plan. So I think more in terms of stocks and income annuities rather than stocks and bonds when it comes to somebody's retirement. With the caveat that holding individual bonds, I think, is also an appropriate strategy. The trade-off is not having the longevity protection with individual bonds, but having more liquidity that you can otherwise do something else with those assets or leave them as a legacy, which can be included as an additional option on an income annuity. But as a life-only annuity, there's no liquidity or flexibility.
Professor, do you think, given the circumstances that we find ourselves today, and especially many retirees, I'm thinking how the whole retirement paradigm has changed in the last several decades. In fact, the last three decades. You know, I think back to the days of my parents. Usually men went to work for a company. They spent 25, 30 years of their career working for a company. They got a Timex watch and they got a pension plan that guaranteed them a certain amount of income based on their salary, very much like what occurs in the government sector today. Then, beginning in the 70s and the 80s, many companies did away with their defined benefit pension plans, and they went to 401k plans where the outcome was less certain. There was no guaranteed pension when you retire. So we had the changing pension dynamics in the private sector, and then along comes with that increasing longevity, and along with that, the change in the financial markets where we're looking at 0% interest rates today and high valuations for stocks. So it seems to me that the whole dynamics of retirement planning have changed rather dramatically here.
Right. With a company pension, the company could pool all the longevity and market risks across all their different workers who enter the market or enter the workforce at different times, retire at different times. All those risks could be pooled. Then, as we've transitioned away from those traditional company-defined benefit pensions, the individual bears all that risk, the longevity risk and the market risk, and they don't have anyone to pool with on their own. So they have to seek some other outlet to pool those risks, or otherwise they have to bear all the market and longevity risk on their own, which ultimately means if they decide to go it alone, they have to be conservative. They have to assume low market returns, which is not necessarily a bad assumption with the current market environment. And they have to assume they're going to live a long time, which both suggests they have to spend conservatively. So it's a challenge not having that ability on one's own to pool those kinds of risks with other individuals. That's where an income annuity can help fill that gap.
Well, there are a lot of different strategies today, but it seems to me that we're going to have to start rethinking retirement planning. The recent study that you did with one of your associates basically is talking about a rising equity glide path, which is just the opposite of what most people are told or given in most financial plans. You just don't see people saying, well, you know, you're at age 65, you're going to have 40% in stocks, but by age 75, we expect that to increase another 10% and another 10% when you're age 80. Just the opposite of what most people expect. And it also might be something they're uncomfortable with. A good example is this recent downdraft that we got in the market in August. A lot of people were cashing out of stocks, withdrawals from ETFs, and you can't play the market timing game in retirement because I think it's a dangerous thread to follow. Professor, as we close, any parting advice you would tell to prospective retirees today or an individual that has recently retired? Any words of wisdom?
Yeah, as you were hinting at there, just to keep in mind that your risk capacity or your ability to bear market declines and still maintain your lifestyle gets diminished when you enter retirement. And so you do have to think about it differently. It's different from just saving for retirement where you're still in the labor force, you're still working, and you still have that flexibility to either stay in the labor force or to make some other kinds of minor adjustments. You lose a lot of that flexibility once you enter into retirement. You're more vulnerable to market volatility because as you're taking distributions from your portfolio, that traditional dollar cost averaging transforms into reverse dollar cost averaging. You have to sell more shares to get the same amount of income. And so it's a different problem, and people do need to take care to really think about it carefully and understand retirement income planning is different from saving for retirement.
Are you seeing that change come about in the industry itself? In other words, is financial planning, I mean, we have found from experience in just doing financial planning over decades that we have found more effective predictability, either using immediate annuities or laddered bond portfolios, as well as individual stocks that have a history of paying dividends.
I think there's growing recognition, and the American College now has the Retirement Income Certified Professional designation for advisors that has now grown to be the most popular designation at the college. For the first time in its history, back to the 1920s, it's now more popular than the life insurance designation that the college was originally created to provide. So it's a really hot topic now, and I think a lot of financial advisors and individuals preparing for retirement are seeking more information and knowledge about retirement income.
Well, Professor, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, how can they do so, please?
My website is retirementresearcher.com. I blog regularly about different retirement income topics, and so it's all there, just retirementresearcher.com.
Professor, as always, thanks for joining us on the program. All the best to you, and come back and talk to us again.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You know, Jim, Professor Fowle's studies here are really turning a lot of the standard narratives about retirement literally upside down, which is why it's so important to pick someone who knows what they're doing when they're into retirement planning, because what he's saying is the older you get, the more equity you should have because you're concerned about income and you're chasing this little dragon called inflation, which right now is tame, but it might not be someday, you know. But the ability to have this flex built into what you're doing is a real sober, real world analysis of conditions as people are going to have to meet them in retirement.
Yeah, and we've seen, John, people panic with the stock market. And what I think one of the misperceptions, and especially since people invest in mutual funds and ETFs where the outcomes aren't predictable, one of the things that we have found in our own practice doing financial retirement planning for over three decades now, we have found greater success and predictability by using individual bonds or immediate annuities and individual stocks. The value of Coca-Cola can drop in a market correction, but the dividend doesn't change. It actually goes up. And that's the thing that people have to worry about is whatever income or whatever your expenses are today, I can tell you 10 years from now, and especially if you're retired, they're going to be greater. And especially for retirees, as the cost of medical goes up, it's estimated $230,000 to $250,000 out-of-pocket expenses for a couple in retirement. That number may be going up. Anyway, I think the whole world of retirement planning is changing. Gone are defined benefit pension plans. Gone are the security of high interest that we used to get. I mean, think of what you could get on a two-year treasury note. 15 years ago, you could get 5 or 6%. Today, you're lucky if you can get 0.1%. So the whole world of retirement planning is changing, and that's why you have to use and adapt to the environment. Retirement planning is now a dynamic process. It's not something you start with a pie chart the day you retire and that's your plan set and forget it for the next 25 years. That's not the world we live in. Well, in the meantime, well, we're out of time as usual. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.